Hi, and welcome to another edition of the ISI Flyby Show. With a string of qualifications, professional accreditations, and prestigious awards as long as your arm, Professor Bob Stone of Birmingham University chairs the Interactive Multimedia Systems Department in the College of Engineering and the Physical Sciences. He also leads the Human Interface Technologies team. What Bob doesn't know about virtual reality and immersive systems, you almost certainly don't need to know. He is extremely active in the sphere of immersive tech, and especially in some of the most important non-gaming applications of VR, in medicine, health and safety, and training. His work takes him from Royal Navy warships to oil and gas rigs in the North Sea and to medical operating theatres. If you don't know how important the sense of smell will be to virtual reality, you definitely need to hear what Bob has to say.
Brilliant. So, Bob, thank you so much for joining us today. Really fascinating and quite topical subject of virtual reality. So I was just wondering, how do you really define virtual reality? What is it?
Do you know, once upon a time, that would have been so straightforward to answer. And today, it's unfortunately, it's not. But anyway, very briefly, today you see people referring to this thing called XR, extended realities. And that means where there is a letter X, put in virtual, augmented, or mixed. So virtual reality has changed, and it's really evolved over the past 2 to 3 decades. So originally, the idea behind virtual reality was you could put on the headset, which consists of a couple of displays giving you a 3D or stereoscopic view. You could put a glove on, which would then control a virtual glove, disembodied glove, hovering in space. And the whole idea was to use this technology to be able to allow people to explore and interact with things in a computer-generated world. So literally a 3D world, which is very blocky. Since then, briefly, it's become more of a generalist term. And it's not just applying now to wearables, the headsets and the gloves, although they still feature prominently. So things like conventional PCs or laptops, tablets even. We've got haptics or sense of touch and force coming in, smell, motion bases, treadmills, all of which strive and don't necessarily achieve yet, but strive to engage the user intuitively with a range of computer databases, from 3D models to panoramic VR or 3D scans. So it's a whole wide range now what people are classifying as virtual reality.
So the way that it works is advanced software, obviously. The programs must be incredibly complicated.
They are, depending on what you're trying to achieve. The results can be quite simplistic, but for example, in training, you can still achieve an awful lot. So the programs themselves, and this has moved on immensely since the 1990s when we were tinkering with virtual reality, a lot of them are now freely available, particularly for people who want to get involved. And indeed, we have online access to a wealth of 3D assets now. So it's not as tricky to get involved these days as it was 30 years ago. Software is one part. The hardware technologies, do you use a headset? Do you use a screen? Do you use a glove, et cetera, et cetera? That's the other part. And then my part and my interest is, what about the human? Because people still forget there is a human at the end of this. And it's no good just expecting them to put a headset on. And all of a sudden they become immersed and proficient and relaxed in a virtual world. It's not the case. We have to put the human first before we even start thinking about the technology.
We are used to seeing young people with headsets on playing games online, immersive games, they call them, I believe, where the youngster is, or the person concerned, is fully immersed in the world that the game is presenting to them. Is that what you're talking about, or are you talking about a more industrial application of it?
Yeah, certainly more industrial, more commercial, more looking at front-end training in the defence industry and so on. Your issue about youngsters and headsets and gaming is quite interesting, because I have a sneaking suspicion, having got kids and grandkids of my own, that there aren't that many using these headsets for gaming as you might think, because interestingly, you can do much more activities much faster, would you believe, by using a standard keyboard, the good old WASD keys or the arrow keys, and a mouse than a headset, especially if you're sat down. I mean, that's another discussion, I think. But my focus since the late 80s has most certainly been on industrial. Where can this be used for real? And also things like education, healthcare, heritage, and so on. So the serious side of virtual reality, if you like.
We've seen in that case, I was reading the other day there about medical practitioners in the States using VR to train. Mm. Is that the sort of thing that you're talking about, where they have a what's basically a human body in front of them, a virtual body that they can cut open and do all sorts of things to?
Yes, that's part of what we do within healthcare. Although our healthcare interest extends from recovering casualties from the battlefield. That's our main project at the moment, using something called mixed reality,
right,
where we're blending the best of the real with the best of the virtual, right through to, for example, using pure virtual reality in headsets to help people who are at the end of their life, people who are stressed, people with dementia, and so on.
Yeah, like virtual therapy almost.
Absolutely, yeah. This virtual reality and therapy has got, I believe, a rosy future, because you can provide people with their own little world into which they can escape. You can provide them with really good three-dimensional sound, really good three-dimensional images of places they could otherwise not get to, and indeed smells. I mean, we're in an era now where smell for virtual reality is no longer a joke.
Wow.
Yes, I imagine as well with the therapy aspect of it, the ability to simulate situations, scenarios in a completely safe environment, I imagine that's going to be beneficial for a whole wide variety of mental problems.
Oh, I agree completely. From a psychological perspective, if you undergo, for example, hypnosis, one of the things you're trained to do in hypnosis is to use the world that the hypnosis specialist is trying to get you to enter as your own personal space, and you are free to choose who you let into that space. So it gives you that degree of security that you would not normally have in your day-to-day life.
Just to bring it back to another industrial application in terms of pilots, and I also worked for BAC back in the 70s, and one of the big things then was trying to get augmented, what we'd now call augmented reality, for pilots to help them in their jobs. To what extent are pilots actually trainable with virtual reality? Does it work, or are there limitations?
Well, I would argue that pilots have been trained using virtual reality for decades and decades, because mixed reality.
Yeah.
So you're sat in a real cockpit, and that real cockpit is flying through virtual space.
Yeah.
But you're right. More recently, there have been attempts also using mixed reality, using these headsets that are modified with cameras that can actually see the real world as well as put you in a virtual space.
Yeah.
You are seeing a lot more affordable part task training packages coming in for helicopter pilots, for military pilots, and so on. So yes, I mean, the pilot training situation has been with us all along. Augmented reality, probably not so much. Augmented reality, in my view, is still very immature, and we've got an awful, well, apart from things like head-up displays.
Yeah.
I suppose they're a form of augmented, but the augmented reality you see, for example, when you see people putting on things like the HoloLens or other augmented reality headsets.
Yeah.
Long way to go before that becomes mainstream, regardless of what you see online.
What are the barriers to that then?
The barriers to good quality augmented reality are things like the available field of view for the headset. So, for example, if you put on a really augmented reality headset, you will see a little screen in front of you.
Yeah.
And that little screen typically contains things like, and some of the smart glasses are like this too, but they will contain things like video, if you're lucky. They will contain maybe very simple schematic maps. They'll contain, I'm thinking of the little headset that I use when I go drone flying on Dartmoor, but little maps, save waypoints, back to base, altitude, alphanumeric little blips.
Yeah.
They don't do very well is actually have a convincing virtual world that's superimposed upon the real.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
As soon as you take an augmented reality headset, out into open space, out to the open, the whole illusion is killed. You get glare,
right.
You get reflection, and it really is quite appalling at the moment. Some companies are trying to overcome that by having adjustable optics, you know, like the good reactor light glasses we used to have years and years ago. But the problem is, the more the darker you make the headset, the more it becomes a virtual reality headset. And then you get to the problems of people walking into lampposts and.
So how real then would these experiences get in virtual reality? How immersive is immersive would be the best question.
Yeah, actually, there's two questions there. Sorry to hear. How real are they? Some of them are very real. Some of the demonstrations you can get, for example, using the games engine, the powerhouse behind games, so is Unreal. Some of their forests, some of their snow scenes, some of their maps are very, very, very good indeed. And you can download some of these completely free of charge. Others, not so. I mean, there's so many things missing in a virtual world that it's still, to get onto your second part of your question, we're still decades and decades away from the Star Trek holodeck, where we can walk in somewhere completely unencumbered and we can taste, smell, reach out, touch realistically, and explore for miles. It's gradually getting there, but I have to say, not in our lifetime.
And that's a matter of technology, is it? It's the electronics, the materials that are the problem, rather than just the software.
Yeah, I think the software is probably there to achieve a lot of it now, but it's the technology of making the virtual world seamless. So you right. don't have to constantly subtly move the. If you're within a room, and some entertainment centres do this, you can actually subtly move the virtual world to create this illusion that you're moving in an infinite space. And it kind of works. Sometimes it falls down when you smash into a wall. But in terms of things like I think the Star Trek folks call it hard photons. Where you can literally create things that evolve in front of you, reach out and touch them, taste them, drink them, smell them. We're a long way away from technology generating that.
It can be quite bizarre, the experience of VR as well. I mean, I had the pleasure of testing it out for free at a museum event one time, and the entire generated world was beautiful, stunning, looked very realistic. And then I looked down and my body was missing.
Yeah.
So it was very disconcerting. I imagine that's got to be quite a large part of it, is the generation of oneself within this virtual reality as well.
Oh, indeed. And again, you've hit a major topic on the head. I was reading a paper this morning about how you can encourage people of all ages to appreciate their body image greater if they see themselves as a superhero. Quite into the paper. But I think, and that's one of the beauties of mixed realities. With our headset, for example, you can look down and you can see your body. So you can see your real hands. You can see the casualty mannequin. But when you look around, because we're using blue screen technology, similar to what they use on the weather forecast, you're in a virtual helicopter or a virtual tank. But you're right. Being able to see parts of your own body that move identically with your body, and this is something we had in the 90s, it was dreadful. Not only does that give you more confidence, but it also minimizes the incidence of what we call cyber sickness, So this is the disorientation, nausea, and sometimes vomiting that we see with people who simply cannot adapt to putting these headsets on.
Is that a serious problem? Does it affect many people? What sort of proportion?
3 to 5% of the population will suffer from cyber sickness no matter what. And that's because of their physiological makeup. They may have issues with their eyes. Females tend to suffer
Right.
more than males. In the main, it's something you can adapt out. So if you expose people who may experience being a little bit icky when they put a headset on for the first time, giving them short, sharp chunks of the experience over an extended period, it's like getting sea legs. It's like
Yeah.
it's exactly like that. There's always and there's always an element of disorientation when you come back into the real world.
I
So
can
it's
imagine, yeah.
again like being on a ship. You come back on land and you're having to modify your posture because you've been on a vessel that's moving around. Very,
Yes.
very similar.
The way that virtual reality is sold is mainly as a training aid in the commercial world. What sort of training applications have you been involved in?
Well, certainly defense. We've been involved in quite a few training applications. I mean, things like training patrols to be familiar with markers that terrorists may leave embedded in the war or on the ground
Yeah.
or patterns of rocks and things. Things like the mixed reality medical emergency response team training, which is our mainstream project at the moment. That's going great guns. And I mean, even things like weapons training, helicopter search and rescue,
Yeah.
we've been working in those as well. So there's quite a wide variety of training and defense. Other industrial applications, nuclear, chemical, gas plant maintenance,
Yeah.
train
Yeah.
for evacuation, things like obviously we've already touched on the healthcare side of things. Maritime ships, bridges, again using virtual reality to enhance the situational awareness, as the military love to call it,
Yeah.
of their immediate and far out surroundings.
So fundamentally, what we're doing here is replacing very expensive training scenarios with a much cheaper form of immersive training.
Yes,
Yeah.
that's absolutely right. I mean, there are people who claim that current generation virtual reality tech is expensive, and to some it is. But when you
Yeah.
compare with what we had in the 1990s, that claim that it's expensive today always makes me smile.
Of course, there's a whole wide variety of commercial uses, but of course, with everyone coming in with their own private headsets, and of course, with we have to mention it, the metaverse being a hot topic in recent months, I imagine there's quite a
Indeed.
lot of controversy about whether or not people believe that will actually have legs in the future.
I like the way you say have legs. If you look at most of the avatars in the metaverse, they haven't got bottoms. They have neither bottoms nor legs.
That's true.
Yes, I'm probably not the best person to talk about the metaverse because I actually truly believe it's a bit of a money-making gimmick.
Yeah.
Replicating, to be honest, replicating what's gone before. Back in the 90s, we saw researchers in Sweden pull together
Yeah.
something that they called a shared virtual world.
Yeah.
And okay, the avatars may have been simple, flat, plain images of people who were participating, but it was a shared virtual world. Today, everything you see on, I mean, I'm kind of, I subscribe, for example, to LinkedIn, and the number of things that we see that are pure virtual reality, they've now got the metaverse stamp because
Yeah.
people think that if they use metaverse, they will get investment. And there are people, the metaverse, they're getting around this shared virtual world thing, which of course we saw with Second Life back in the noughties, and Second Life is what's still going. They're talking about things like it's persistent. In other words, it carries on and evolves even at the same time as we live our own lives. It's online, it's massive, it's got interoperable features that span the digital and the real domains. There's an awful lot hype and talk about it, and people are investing billions. $1.75 billion or pounds, no pounds, was actually invested in virtual land last
Oh my
year,
goodness.
12 months. And people are just, I always say, well, a fool and his or her money are easily parted. And I think the metaverse is showing us now. I think time will tell. Even as we speak, visitor numbers to metaverses, because they're all still very individual pockets of shared virtual worlds. There's no global metaverse yet. Will there
No.
be? Who knows? Who will be in charge of it? God help us, who knows? But visitor numbers are dropping. They're dropping like a stone, and the quarterly investments have been going down since 2021.
I think, I mean, I must admit, I think you're right. The way that virtual reality works, though, seems to me to have great benefits as long as the applications are well thought out and reasonably tight, limited. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would absolutely agree with that. And I go even further by saying the way virtual reality works and is destined to succeed is as long as I said earlier on that we put the human before technology. Every project that my team and I do, and this, yes, I would say this because I'm a human factors specialist, I'm biased, but everything we do, we spend time observing or working with the end users before we go anywhere near recommending technology. Because I would say 50% of the times, they don't need virtual reality. They really, but they want it because they've seen all about it and heard all about it,
Because it's
but they
cool,
don't need it. But you're right. Where virtual reality is going to work is when people spend time looking at the real people doing real jobs in the real world.
It's very easy to see the benefits of that sort of thing. One of the things that I'm fascinated with, and I know you know a lot about, is haptics and the things, if you like, that would help to make virtual reality real for people.
Yes. Well, I have this rather dubious honor of having designed and invented the world's first haptic feedback glove back in 1990. It's called Teletag.
Great.
And even appeared on Tomorrow's World. Us older members of society will remember with fondness Tomorrow's World
Raymond Baxter, yeah.
opposed to what they have on BBC now, but I won't go there. We actually found ourselves desperate to create some degree of touch sensation because the virtual reality headsets were so bad, and you had to stick your virtual hand into a virtual object, and then you had to go through a gesture on your glove to get the computer to recognize that you've picked it up. And you just spent most of your time flailing in space trying to make that happen. So we designed the Teletact haptic feedback glove by having little air pockets on the bottom of the hand, which inflated, and that's all they did. What they managed to get it to do on Tomorrow's World, I'll never really truly believe. I think that was either a fluke, or I underestimated the technology more than I did at the time. Since the Teletact days, and it's easy for me to say this, I'm sure, but since Teletact, things haven't changed that much at all. If you look at some of the monstrosities that they're expecting people to wear today, and I won't mention any product names specifically, but they're doing not much more. Okay, they may be using microfluidics to achieve exactly the same pressure effect on the fingertips, or they may be using hand exoskeletons to restrict the movement of the hand, or in some cases they're using what we call mid-air haptics, which are columns of air generated by ultrasonic sensors, where you are supposed to put your hand out and feel something in space. Lovely idea, doesn't work. Simply doesn't work. And yes, we do desperately need, if virtual reality is going to become holodeck-like, we need something that's going to give us that credible sense of touch and credible sense of weight and gravity. We're nowhere near there yet. Again, we are many, many years away from that happening, which is one of the reasons why we use the mixed reality approach. Because when you reach out and you can see your real hand, and you're touching a real object inside a virtual Chinook helicopter. That's haptic. You feel it. It's none of this nonsense of your hand disappearing into a virtual body, and then you're suddenly getting something tickling the bottom of your hand, which is what happens today. You actually feel something. And I actually believe that I think we're going to see more developments, more credible developments in smell sooner than we are haptics.
Wow.
With
Right.
the
Well,
first
you've just opened
step.
yourself up to that one, I'm
Yeah.
afraid. Well, tell us about that.
I think sound, it was like in the 1990s, sound was seriously underrated in virtual reality until people started introducing sound, such as the sound of waves on the beach, on the virtual beach or whatever, the sound of wind. And all of a sudden, the level of immersion went from, yeah, it's okay, to, wow, yes. I feel more present now than I was. Now, we've been experimenting with smell using other people's products, I hasten to say, mostly from the States, for the best part of 8 to 10 years. And it still has its problems. The smells themselves are still immature. Culturally, there are issues in that individuals from different backgrounds and cultures smells differently to what the smell vendor wants us to smell, if you got that, which is an
Wow.
interesting research problem. So when I give up smells to my students and ask them what it is, the Indian, the Chinese students, and those from other countries will actually classify it different from those. It's a very interesting research topic.
That's interesting. Yeah. I'd never heard that before.
No, it's not something we've had a chance to do some real research on, but I'm certainly talking to people who build these smell systems. So last year and the year before, we started experimenting with a new smell system, which is developed by a company in the States called OVR Technology. And a fabulous piece of equipment. It's literally the size of a printer cartridge, contains nine chambers, and these chambers have this spring-operated mechanism that oscillates very, very quickly and then jettisons the smell out towards your nose, and it clips onto the bottom of headsets. So we worked with them to produce the smells of the 1620s to go with our virtual reality Mayflower demonstration, where you're walking along the old
Yeah.
Barbican in Plymouth, and the 1620s were disgusting. There was animal feces, human feces, urine, poorly made perfumes by the ladies of the night, really smelly fishy harbors, and so on. Some of them worked really well. A lot of them didn't work very well at all because of the cultural difference. So the Americans, when I asked the Americans to generate a smell that smelled strongly of human poo, what we got was nothing like it. And I don't know whether it's because they were too embarrassed, which is a shame. Or because their smell or their sense of smell of poo is different from the British sense of smell of poo.
Wow.
And it really is fundamental that some of the smells that we've tested are not what you expect. And one of the smells that we're desperate to get a hold of at the moment is aviation fuel, after.
Well, kerosene.
It's like kerosene, but it's
Yeah, but
not.
not. Yeah.
It's not. It's and the RAF people recognise that it's not kerosene, but it's what all the guys and gals smell of for hours, sometimes days, when they come off the back of a Chinook.
Yeah.
And they just at the moment, but they can't supply us with that. We're hoping maybe within the next year or so that will change. But smell has links to memory, it has links to
Yeah.
emotion. It is an incredibly potent sense that I think stands more chance of making that next leap into immersion than haptics.
But if smell is cultural in the sense that it's different cultures, because you're drawing a distinction there between the Americans and the British, where who you would think would smell things pretty much the same way. We're both Westerners, mainly European stock and so on. So if the Chinese or the Indians don't smell something the same, and the Americans don't smell the same thing in the same way, then you're going to have to develop smell systems that are culturally specific.
Yeah, and I would agree. I think that's what's going to happen. I think that that once these companies start to prove the value of smell, and I don't think that's a particularly difficult problem, I think they're going to have to start looking at cultural specificity. I really do, because
Yeah.
otherwise it's going to, again, it's if we don't, then we are going to be providing trainees with smells that smell nothing like what they're going to smell when they go out to the real world. And for example, in defense,
Yeah.
healthcare, that could be quite crucial.
Yeah. Where do you think if the smell problem can be overcome in the next few years, where do you think it's going to be most useful?
Right, I think it's going to be useful in, for example, areas of health and safety. So yes, it's going to be useful in defense.
Yeah.
Not just for reproducing the smells of injured casualties on the back of helicopters, but things like training people to recognize the onset of an electrical fire in a submarine. So if you're walking down the corridor, and
Yeah.
we've done submarine training using VR to be able to walk past the galley or to walk past the senior ratings mess and
Yeah.
suddenly pick up the smell of electrical fire,
Yeah.
the safety implications of that are huge. Healthcare, most definitely. I think having smells, and we all know this ourselves, that we every so often we will smell something that will literally transport us back to when we were kids,
Yeah, yeah.
our first girlfriend or boyfriend, our first walk in the forest, our first smell of the sea. So I think healthcare, defense, industry, as far as where it comes to health and safety, and training individuals to recognize safety critical smells. I think things like heritage, which we're very strongly involved in, so adding smells to our virtual, not just the 1620s Mayflower, but also to a lot of the reconstructions of places on Dartmoor, for example, where Bronze Age habitation or things that existed in the early part of the century, late 1800s.
Yeah,
Again,
yeah.
historical. And education too. When once you start introducing smells, and people, even kids, will remember that kind of experience when you provide them with something that would otherwise just be another game type walkthrough.
Yeah,
Do you
yeah.
think it might get involved then with the virtual reality gaming?
Oh yes, yeah, it can't fail to. I think it's like a lot of things with virtual realities. Virtual realities had serious peaks and troughs since the 1980s, late 1980s. And I think gaming came in and saved virtual reality in the end of the 1990s, early 2000s. No doubt about it. Without the gaming people producing their toolkits for building worlds and their graphics cards for the computers, virtual reality would have struggled, if not ceased to exist, at least for a short while. But I think, yes, I think the games companies, as long as it's affordable, we will ultimately see either standalone smell dispensers, and they've tried this in the past, not particularly successfully. Standalone game dispensers that sit on your desk, or headset integrated smell dispensers that will be tuned to a specific game. So obviously, you mentioned Cordite and blood and guts and goodness knows what else. The games industry will undoubtedly pick it up.